Hey everyone, welcome to Brain Health with Dr. Nissen. In this show, we explore the universe's great unknown, the human brain. In my reflections and interviews with guests, we'll go to the forefront of psychiatry, neuroscience, nutrition, and medicine to see how we can enhance our mental health, sharpen our cognition, and reach better performance. This is Brain Health, and I'm Dr. Nissen. Let's dive right in. In this episode, you'll learn about the Mediterranean diet, the science behind extra virgin olive oil, and how we can make dietary changes to minimize our risks for dementia and mental illness. So I'm here with Mary Flynn. She is a PhD, as well as several other letters after her name. Actually, do you want to mention what those are?
Sure. I'm a registered dietitian. And then I think almost everyone in the country is licensed, but we have to say we're licensed. That LDN is licensed dietitian and nutritionist. That's supposed to say that I have the background to talk about nutrition as opposed to a chiropractor or a trainer. They are not supposed to talk about nutrition by the law, but I know they still do.
Okay. So she is an associate professor of medicine at Brown University. She teaches courses in nutrition at Brown. She lectures on nutrition at the Alpert Medical School, Brown University. She also has been a research dietitian at the Miriam Hospital in Providence, Rhode Island since 1984. Her main research interest is how food can be used as medicine. And her main food of interest is extra virgin olive oil, which she has been researching since 1998. So with all of those amazing things that she's been doing, welcome to the show, Mary.
Thank you. Thank you, Nick.
Yeah, of course. So I wanted to start with a discussion about the Mediterranean diet and maybe to orient myself and our listeners, I think it'd be good to start with just a definition of what is the Mediterranean diet.
Sure. And that's an important question because now it is confusing to look at the literature and know actually what you are talking about. So the Mediterranean diet traditionally refers to the diet that was consumed by the people who lived around the Mediterranean Sea. So it could be a whole country like Greece, or it could be part of a country like southern France, southern Italy. But what it is it was a diet of necessity. It was plant-based because it was a very inexpensive diet. Listeners that were around in the 90s or adults in the 90s will remember it used to be called a peasant diet. It's a very inexpensive way to eat, but it's very healthy. It's all plant-based. Very few animal products. A little bit of cheese used, a little bit of yogurt, but you did not daily have poultry or seafood or whatever. So why I say it's important to define it is now what it's morphed into is a couple of things. If you were to just Google it or look for a cookbook that said Mediterranean diet, now you see poultry in most of the recipes or seafood. The other thing is in the research setting, it's now defined most likely by the ratio of monounsaturated fat to saturated fat. So why that's a problem is you're talking about nutrients, not food. Now, olive oil, whether it's olive oil or extra virgin olive oil, extra virgin is the one with the health benefits, is high in monounsaturated fat. So if you're analyzing a diet in a Mediterranean country, you'd pick up a lot of extra virgin olive oil. Outside of those countries, in the United States, in Great Britain, most of Europe, when you do monounsaturated fat, you are not picking up olive oil, certainly not picking up extra virgin olive oil. But in the United States, what you're picking up is salad oils. So that could be canola, safflower, soybean. But more importantly, what you're picking up is beef. About up until 2005, the major source of monounsaturated fat in the American diet was beef. And then it was overtaken by salad oils because that includes frying oils. So now it's a little more than half of the monounsaturated fat is coming from beef or salad oils. The rest would be distributed in the food system. So when you look at studies that's from the United States, particularly in the last 10, 15 years, when they say the Mediterranean diet, if you look at the methods, if they're defining it by monounsaturated fat to saturated fat, or they'll call it the Med diet score, they get scores for food, and they do include poultry and seafood, you don't see benefit. You do not see the health benefits. And so studies have emerged that said the Mediterranean diet doesn't do this. The Mediterranean diet doesn't do this. And they're all things that we know the Mediterranean diet, in its traditional definition, would improve.
Okay. So it's more about the food than sort of the nutritional aspects.
Yeah. Very much so. I started talking about food and from a nutrition standpoint, I started talking about food in the certainly by the mid-90s. And it just to me made so much more sense, mainly because I initially started off in lipid metabolism when I did research and low-fat diets were coming on the scene. And I knew low-fat diets did not improve health. And I knew that diets rich in olive oil did. So right away, I thought, that's not the answer. It's the food. And that's how I switched to just talking about food. Believe it or not, 25 years ago, that was not mainstream at all. People would always say to me, what do you mean food, not nutrients, whatever. So that's where I became more interested due to olive oil.
Yeah. And that goes along with some of the, I don't know if you read any of Michael Pollan's books, but I was recently reading some of those, and he has a seven word line of eat food, not too much, mostly plants.
Yeah. So well, it's funny. I have read his books, but being in nutrition, this was my interest before he came on the scene. But when his books came out, it's kind of funny because students would say to me, oh, do you get your ideas from Michael Pollan? I said, well, actually, no. I came up with them on my own.
So, of course.
And I'm glad that it's funny because people like him and Mark Bittman have done a wonderful job getting nutrition and getting people thinking about nutrition, more so than nutritionists. I will definitely say that. But I was working in that area way before his books came out, but it was kind of funny when it came out.
Yeah, it's cool to see kind of things come full circle and hopefully, you know, get some of the information that tends to sometimes get stuck in academia to get out into the general public. So it's
very
great to
see. He writes really well. It's very readable. Like Mark Bittman. Mark Bittman, I don't know if he still works for the New York Times, but he does wonderful writing on nutrition. Very readable, very approachable.
Yeah. Well, good. So since we've started with this definition of the Mediterranean diet, maybe we can dive into why it's important, and in particular through the lens of brain health. Why should people consider the Mediterranean diet in comparison to other diets?
Well, so, you know, why does your brain start to, you know, get to fall apart? So you have dementia, or you have Alzheimer's, or, I mean, I don't know the psychiatric part, but I certainly know the dementia and Alzheimer's. You can say at least some of it is related to diet, and mm-hmm. at least some of it is related to things like inflammation, elevated blood glucose, elevated insulin. Those have been related to quicker getting to dementia, more likely to get Alzheimer's, and those are definitely improved by diet. Other things, like if you look at certain vegetables, there's vegetables that are high in salicylic acid, like the berries, pineapple is, grapes are. Then for vegetables, it's processed tomatoes, not fresh tomatoes. The processing makes a different type of tomato. Cucumbers, zucchini. The foods that you say are high in salicylic acid, which could decrease inflammation. But extra virgin olive oil on its own, you can make a case that could be very useful because it has to be extra virgin. That's where you get the health benefits. And what it can do from a standpoint of brain health is it will definitely decrease inflammation. It will definitely decrease oxidation. So oxidation is increased with omega-6 fatty acids. So mm-hmm. omega-6 fatty acids are rich in vegetable seed oils and beef. And that's what the American diet is very high in. So people will say that omega-3 fatty acid is beneficial for dementia and Alzheimer's. But it's the ratio in your blood of omega-3 to omega-6 that determines any health benefits. So just to dump omega-3s on the system, I think is wrong. What I try to get people to do is get rid of their omega-6s as much as they can. So you're not using vegetable seed oils, you're not eating beef. But then extra virgin olive oil, I think one of its more interesting benefits is that it will improve insulin sensitivity. So it makes insulin work better. So it will lower glucose and insulin, and that improves heart disease, cancer, brain right. health. Just amazing what it will improve.
Yeah. And in particular, since you mentioned this, the seed oils, I feel like, I don't know if technically where canola oil would fall, but I feel like I've read a lot of sort of varying information about canola oil. And in comparison, you know, being relatively, I would imagine being relatively unsaturated, but I think having a slightly higher burning point than olive oil. Is there some distinction there that's important?
Well, there's a couple of things. First, to talk about heating. Extra virgin olive oil refers to the juice of the olive, and its health benefits are due to the phenol content in it, not the monounsaturated fat. We know that because studies that compare olive oil that doesn't have phenol content to it to extra virgin olive oil, which has phenol content, you see the benefits with the extra virgin olive oil, not the olive oil. Okay. So when it was known that extra virgin olive oil was healthy, which is like in the 60s and 70s. And I remember these articles, it was when I was starting off in research, they were trying to get an oil onto the American market that would be high in monounsaturated fat because they thought that was the benefit to olive oil. So that's where canola oil came from. Canola oil comes from the rapeseed, and it's actually chemically stripped of these long chain fatty acids. So it's actually a very unstable oil. When you heat it was a study done out of Australia that compared a whole range of oils, extra virgin olive oil, virgin olive oil, which doesn't have the sensory qualities of extra virgin olive oil, coconut oil, grapeseed oil, canola oil, avocado oil. And what they showed was canola oil is extremely unstable when you heat it. It makes these polar compounds, which means it will introduce oxidation into the person. Extra virgin olive oil, by definition, is very low in free fatty acids. So if it is extra virgin olive oil, you actually can bring it to the highest temperature. Now, what people talk about is smoke point, but I think it's important to remember that we don't cook at smoke point. You know, we don't cook that high. We cook like, you might go 450, maybe 470, but you don't go over 500 when you're cooking most things. You might do it for like bread, but there's not fat involved. Mm-hmm. So extra virgin olive oil is the healthiest oil to cook with. It has the highest, it won't smoke if you're going to burn something. It won't smoke that high. So you don't want to use canola oil. So when canola oil came on the market, the name comes from Canada oil, so it's there's no canola plant. And so it was thought to be the answer to olive oil because they felt at that time in the 80s that Americans would not accept an oil that had taste to it, which is interesting because as a general statement, everybody likes extra virgin olive oil. I mean, I know when I first started in research in extra virgin olive oil, before I recruited a participant, I would have olive oil for them to taste because some people had never tasted it 20 years ago. In my 20 years, I've never had someone say to me, I don't like olive oil. If anything, when people start to use olive oil, they eat a lot more vegetables because the vegetables taste so much better.
And as far as sort of the benefits of extra virgin olive oil, you mentioned that, what did you say, is from the phenols?
Yes. They're called phenols, or some people say polyphenols, but I believe chemically, I've talked to this, someone at UC Davis, Selena Wang, who's really, she works in the chemistry, and she said the proper name is phenol. So there's a range of phenols. Some of them aren't known. The phenol content is somewhat determined by the varietal of olive you use, and there's hundreds of varietals. There's not a lot that are mass-produced, mass-grown, because some are easier to grow than others. Like in the United States, I believe there are three main olives grown, and mainly in California. There's also olives being grown in Texas, Georgia, I think Northern Florida, they're like in weird places. But California has a really booming olive oil industry, and they make beautiful, beautiful, delicious olive oil. But these phenols are inherent to the olive. And then what happens is they work like a phytonutrient. When you crush the olive to make the oil, you produce all these new phenols that aren't there in the olive. So olives have some health benefits, but it's really the olive oil, because as you manipulate a plant product, you'll make more phenols. You make more phytonutrients, phenols in the olive oil. So you'll get these ones that, they work in inflammation. Extra virgin olive oil will lower blood pressure, as they say, makes insulin work better, lowers glucose, inflammation. It actually, I don't think this would be related to brain health, but you never know with HDL. HDL is not very easy to move. And I can't move it very much with diet or anything. I may move like 10%, but that's it. But extra virgin olive oil is the only food we have, or medicine, the only thing we have that will not only raise HDL, it improves HDL function. It makes it a better working particle. So it's probably it's one of the reasons it decreases heart disease, extra virgin olive oil does. But there's more things that HDL does. So I'm sure that there are other benefits from that.
Yeah, as well as just reducing atherosclerotic sort of development throughout the body and stroke risk. Very interesting. Okay. So there's all these benefits of extra virgin olive oil. We touched on what the Mediterranean diet is. How do you suggest that people really practically sort of bring these power foods together to craft a really good diet?
Okay. So that's a good question because, you know, as I say, I've been in this business almost 40 years, and you know, you think, how do you get someone to make diet change? And I do have meal plans for people, like a template that I go through people like in oncology or whatever clinic I'm in. I do go through that. But what I have learned mainly from my research is if I can get someone to every day use at least 2 tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil, because that's where you see the benefits. 3 is better. Like I say, 2 at lunch, 1 at dinner, or vice versa. If I can get them to do that and get them to eat vegetables, it's really pretty remarkable how much the diet changed. And I don't know what it is. I can speculate that I think part of it is you and your generation have grown up in a world where people don't have as much fat at meals. When I was a kid, you know, always had some fat at a meal, whether it was, you know, at lunch, like a tuna salad sandwich or chicken salad sandwich, you had all this mayo, you might have peanut butter and jelly, whatever. Now people have very low fat, high protein lunches, like like poultry, like a poultry sandwich. You might have it on whole wheat with a piece of lettuce, but there's no fat in there. And then dinner is the same thing. Like you don't get as much fat. Meat doesn't have as much fat. People are trying to get fat out of the diet. And our brains look for fat. You know, that's like a it's known in like the nutrition thing. Like if you, in the nutrition area, if you eat a meal that's really low in fat, you finish the meal, it could be full, you could eat a lot of calories, but you're not satisfied. So when I teach it to my students, I equate it to eating, you know, an ounce of potato chips or an ounce of pretzels. Both will fill you up, but the potato chip, because of the fat in it, you feel satiated. So if there's fat in the meal, you're satiated. So what I find is when people have a lunch and a dinner with olive oil, without even telling them to, what happens is they don't eat as many snacks, they don't eat as much dessert, they don't have that desire. Now they might still want that food, but if they're not hungry and not craving that food, that really helps. I mean, they might still eat it, but they're not as likely to eat it. So I think fat can be really important in a meal. Extra virgin olive oil being a healthy fat, it's a nice combination.
Yeah. And so you were saying, you know, having a couple of tablespoons kind of spread throughout the day. Is there, are there particular sort of like go-to meals that you have or times that you suggest to, you know, to have these meals and what they kind of look like?
Okay. Yeah, that's good. So what has happened also is a lot of things have happened since 1990, which is pretty interesting when I look at it, because I remember life before and after that. Low-fat diets, I think, just ruined nutrition research. They ruined people's diets. They led to obesity, whatever. So what I try to get people to do is to delay their breakfast as much as they can, meaning you don't wake up and eat. You don't have to as an adult. Kids do, little babies do, but the rest of us, we don't. So what it means is you wake up, your insulin is the lowest it's going to be all day. So when your insulin is low, your body has to access fat for energy. That's what it's going to do. If the insulin is high, you're storing nutrients like fat. So if you wake up in the morning and you can exercise at that time, you can access more fat. Now you delay your breakfast. So whether or not you can, you know, depending on what time you have to go to work, but can you get your breakfast to like say 8:30, even 9 o'clock, whether that's at home or bringing it with you, which is, you know, which you can do at least some days of the week. So you eat your breakfast at 9, and then 4 or 5 hours later, you're hungry for lunch, 4 or 5 hours later, you're hungry for dinner. So when I work with patients, I try to get them to figure out when they're going to sleep and then when their dinner is, and then you go backwards for lunch and breakfast. So what happens there is you're only eating 3 times a day. And the benefit to that is a couple of benefits. One of the main benefits from a weight loss standpoint is we are less able to access calories from large amounts of food. So if you ate a whole bunch of snacks, those are small amounts of food, small amounts of calories, you can grab those calories, you can gain weight. So snacking is really good for little kids, growing kids, old people, sick people, people in chemotherapy, whatever. The rest of us, no. 3 meals are the way to go. You don't get as many calories. It's wasted. It's called thermic effect of food. The other thing is, if you're only eating 3 times a day, you have these peaks and valleys in your insulin and glucose. And now, so that means when you get that valley, you're going to access fat for energy. But if you're eating all day, you're going to have this level field of glucose and insulin available, and it's going to feed cancer. It's going to feed atherosclerotic tissue, not good for your brain. So there's all these things that come off of it. So what I try to get people to do is meal plan, which I always say sounds so home economic-y, I know. But meal planning just means I know what my next meal is. I have a rough idea what my breakfast is. I'm either bringing my lunch, or I know it's best if you can bring it, but I know what I'm going to purchase, and I know what my dinner is. The more you can do that, the better it is for your head. Because what happens is, I work a lot with the food insecure population. So this is a population that doesn't have money for the next meal. So this is a constant problem for them, because if you don't have money for food and you don't know where your next food is coming from, it sets up all this stuff in your head that just is really toxic. I mean, all the way around. But for the rest of us, if you know what your lunch is, and so you're hungry, let's say 11, 11:30, even 12. If you're hungry, you can wait. I mean, you can wait an hour. It's not going to kill you. Same thing at the end of the day. If you know the best as you can what time you're going to eat your dinner, you're probably going to be hungry an hour and a half before that. But if you know what your dinner is, you can wait. But if you don't know, if you're coming home and think, oh, should I pick up pizza? Should I pick up a meal? What do I have? Should I defrost chicken? Should I get some fish? Whatever. That's where people start to snack. They start to eat food, grab food. So my recipes, I call them, it's a plant-based olive oil meal. They all start with 1 or 2 tablespoons of olive oil. And there's a cup of vegetables per tablespoon of olive oil. And then there's starch, pasta, rice, potatoes, bread, whatever. And that how much starch you have is dependent on how many calories. So in a typical day, a woman has around 6 or 7 servings of starch. So a serving of starch is 1 ounce of breakfast cereal, a slice of bread, 3 ounces of raw potato, 1 ounce dry weight of pasta, about 1/2 cup of cooked rice. So you can figure that out. So if I can get a patient to try to eat this way at least a couple of days a week, that's my goal. That's all I say to them. I never expect anyone to change their whole life, but if you can try to change a couple of days, maybe a few more meals, maybe some lunches, then I think what people realize is they feel better. I got that from when I first started using this diet. That was one of the first things I got from patients was, I feel better. And I always say to my students, you know, at your age, that might, I know it has meaning, but as you get older, it's like, well, I think what it means is the person has slept better. People say they sleep better on this type of diet. What happens with a meat-based diet is meat, particularly beef, is really hard to digest. And we don't, you don't realize it till you're off it. And so if you have beef at dinner, you're not sleeping as well. So you're not sleeping as well. So the next day you don't feel as well. You might overeat because, you know, you're tired or whatever. People say to me, I have more energy. And I think that comes from this starch throughout the day. This idea that protein is beneficial is wrong. It's a misguided piece of information because our need for protein is really low. And if we overeat protein, if we exceed our needs for the day, which most, I'd say, even vegans can exceed their protein. If you're exceeding your protein, what happens is those amino acids, extra ones, are broken down and stored as fat. It's a really easy way to get fat, and it gives you no energy. It's a really expensive way for your body biochemically to get energy. So if you go to a moderate amount of protein and include starch, you're going to feel better, have more energy, whatever. The other thing that happens is when people go on a lower carbohydrate, higher protein diet, your body will maintain your blood glucose, regardless of your status, diabetic or otherwise, but it will maintain your blood glucose, and it does that by robbing skeletal muscle. So it's this whole mixed up biochemistry in your body. When you go low carb, it is not healthy, it's more expensive, it's more complicated to put together, and it just isn't good for your body.
Okay, so kind of then the main staples of the meal or of the diet then are the fats and the starch. And the vegetables, and the protein doesn't need to be as big of a component.
No, you can get all the protein you need from starch and vegetables. Mm-hmm. If you look at vegan diets, a true vegan diet, which is kind of funny now because that term has morphed, I find, into people who just don't eat meat, and they might be eating, you know, God knows what for lunch. I mean, I had a patient recently, a healthy patient, who was using an Ensure for lunch. I mean, that's not a vegan diet. A vegan diet means as many vegetables as you can get into. And a word on that, a couple of things is, even though in the United States it said fruits and vegetables, if you look at the literature, how food impacts disease development, vegetables are much more likely to improve our health over fruit. Fruit probably does, but the literature's not there. I'm not saying it's bad. That's why I emphasize vegetables. Vegetables also have a lot less calories. Then the other thing is, what makes vegetables healthy? Things like color, or the whole cruciferous family, cauliflower, broccoli, kale, that crowd, cabbage. The components that provide health need fat to be absorbed. So if you're eating those vegetables without fat, you are not getting into your body what will fight cancer, that will fight the diseases that come from them. And so you're not getting that benefit. So cooking them in olive oil, or preparing them in olive oil, cooking means you get more into your body. The components come in with the chylomicron, definitely the carotenoids come in, the colorful components come in with the carotenoids. The components in the glucosinolates, the components in the cruciferous vegetables that are called glucosinolates, those are water soluble. And patients are very likely to steam their broccoli, steam their cauliflower. They're losing all that cancer protection. But they are preserved in fat. And I don't know how they're preserved. They might come in with the chylomicron. No one has shown that. But they're definitely shown to be preserved in fat, meaning they'll get into your body.
And so perhaps it'd be better for cruciferous vegetables to cook them in oils as opposed to steam them.
Yes,
so definitely. Like roast them in the oven with with oil drizzle on them.
Yep, that'd be good. Sea salt is always good.
Awesome. All right, this is all new information for me. So I'm really glad we're having this chat. All right. So, and then one other thing I want to touch upon is, you know, you talked about delaying the breakfast in the morning as a way to sort of take advantage of our insulin being the lowest. If we can get exercise in that time, we could access our fat storage. Would there be a possible benefit then to trying to make the dinner a little lower in the starch as a way to sort of help to bring the insulin even lower into the morning, or not necessarily?
Well, I don't know. Because it depends on how much starch you have. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, the idea that starch is bad is just so misplaced. I just have such a problem with that. So if you're not overeating starch, like most males, about 4 servings at dinner is fine. So 4 is reasonably generous. Now, you may be used to eating, you know, 1/2 pound of pasta. And so if you cut it in half, does that look like less to you? Yes. But if you get people to realize what does a reasonable amount of starch look like, as opposed to how much people are consuming. And a lot of that has been driven by restaurants. So when I talk to patients about servings, people think of portions. And portions means how much do you eat, which can be completely different from serving size. It usually is.
Right.
Go to, like, if you went to, say, like a nice Italian restaurant, you got a side of pasta. I remember this as a kid. I mean, you got about 2 or 3 ounces. It was like this much of pasta. It was a very small amount. But now I will periodically ask in a restaurant, if it's a pasta dish, how much pasta are you serving? And they always are serving 8 ounces. That is a lot of pasta. Mm. So that's how eating out becomes a problem, because people are used to finishing that portion. Now they come home, this looks so small. But if that reasonable amount of starch is accompanied by a couple of cups of vegetables cooked in olive oil, the bulk is there. And so you feel full when you finish the meal, and the olive oil keeps you from getting hungry. So it's a nice combination. When I started using these diets, one of the first things I got back from patients' feedback, unsolicited feedback, was, I am not hungry and I'm losing weight. And that sounds like magic. It's not magic. Your calories are controlled. It's just that, why do people go off weight loss diets? They're hungry. That's like the major reason. The compliance goes down. Right. So the olive oil keeps them from getting hungry, and they'll stay on the diet and they can lose weight better. The other thing I got was, this is so inexpensive. So people look at extra virgin olive oil and think it's expensive. But if you do price per tablespoon, it's actually pretty reasonable. And considering it functions almost as much like a medicine, it's really cheap. So that gets into buying of olive oil, which I'll just touch on for you, is that in the United States, the government does not well control labeling of extra virgin olive oil. Mm-hmm. So you go to a market and you really don't know what you're buying. You have to know if it's a reputable company. Now, some I know, like Cola Vita is very good. This is a company called Cobram Estates. Those are ones that I know because I work with them and I know that they do testing. There are certainly other ones out there. I just don't know who they are. And I'm always saying to companies, send me your data. If your data is good, I will recommend you. But what you can look for is the California Olive Oil Council. It's COOC. Mm-hmm. They have a little label that they put on olive oils out of California. If you live on the West Coast, you can get a ton of really good, many brands of really good extra virgin olive oil that are Californian, but there isn't enough product to get it to the East Coast, so we don't get that much. Now, one little problem is, there's a company out there that broadcasts a California on their label, but they are not California olive oil. So if you see the word California on the front, I'm not going to say the name on in the event they're going to turn around and sue me, but if you see the name California on the bottle, look at the ingredients. And if it says 100% California olive oil, fine. If it says olive oil from Spain, Italy, I think they use Tunisia. And they have California, I think, last. They put a drop of California in. They've kept the label. And it's unfortunate because they are someone who distributes to the East Coast. And it used to be my go-to olive oil, but they changed 2 years ago. It's a story, but they mess things up. But California olive oil is really fabulous. I mean, they make wonderful, wonderful. And I think they had a really good harvest last year, was my understanding. Mm. I don't know what's going to happen now with, you know, quarantine and things all messed up. But they've harvested their oil. So the oil would be ready by now to ship. I just don't know. I don't know what we'll get.
So I was reading about this idea of the dietary inflammatory index. And based on what I'd read about it, it seems like it's basically like cholesterol, saturated fats, or sort of the nutrients that had the highest inflammatory index. And I don't know if you have thoughts about that.
The term is vaguely familiar, but what's happened is you have people like Tom Brady's trainer writing books and saying this is an anti-inflammatory diet. And he says eggplant's inflammatory. I don't know where he's getting that from. I do know that the leaves of the nightshade family, both eggplant, tomato, and I want to say potato, their leaves have, they are not healthy. I won't even say they're toxic. I'm not sure. They're not good. But the actual eggplant itself is not inflammatory. So when you look at, does something cause inflammation, I think from my understanding, the only thing we know that is pro-inflammatory is omega-6 fatty acids. And so that's your vegetable seed oils and which is mainly soybean in the United States diet. Now it was safflower before that, it was corn before that. And then it's eating fruits and vegetables, as I said, like the ones that are high in salicylic acid. So it'll be berries, it'll be grapes. It's broccoli, cucumber, green peppers, processed tomatoes, spinach, I believe, sweet potatoes. So adding those, it was one abstract, oh, it's probably 15 years old now, where they looked at people who were vegetarians and they looked at their blood levels of salicylic acid and compared them to people on aspirin. And there was a crossover, which is interesting. You know, so I used to always joke, if you ate a lot of vegetables, do you feel less pain? I don't know. But, you know, you'd say it could come to that. But I don't know how useful that would be, because people, I know I've seen articles where they've used it and they've talked about the glycemic index of food. I give the glycemic index of food little to no value. Reason being is it is affected by so many things, meaning that if you look at, for instance, fruits and vegetables, when fruits are first formed, they are mainly a more complex carbohydrate. They ripen to smaller carbohydrate units, so they become sweet. When they first come off the vine, they're not sweet, they ripen to sweet. Vegetables do the reverse. Vegetables are sweet when they first come out of the plant, come up off the ground or whatever, and then they ripen to something that's less sweet. So you have to know the age of the vegetable. You have to know the particle size. And that's how I think potatoes got a bad rap. Potatoes, actually, a baked potato has a fair amount of fiber in it. It does not have a high glycemic index. But if you were to look at a table, potatoes as a potato would rank worse than potato chips, because potato chips have fat in them. So they're delayed absorption. So, and then, you know, it's a mixed meal. It doesn't make sense. If you have essential amino acids, like you have an animal protein, you secrete more insulin, so you lower the glucose. I just don't find it useful. So when people have these indexes, they include things like French fries. And I think it's because most French fries are not actual potatoes. You know, you see on a menu made with real potatoes. Most of them are a pulverized potato, like a instant potato, like a box potato. And those are absorbed more quickly. But to say a potato has a high glycemic index, I don't get it. It doesn't make any sense.
Would you still suggest to people that they try to, whenever they're eating a starch, to combine in fats or maybe a small amount of protein or vegetable to lower the glycemic index? Or you think it's completely...
I don't think the glycemic index has any value. I really don't. Because when it first came out, it was supposed to be done for diabetics. And that's when, for years, all through the 80s, the carrots were labeled as bad. And they must have just used new carrots, that's all, or grated them or something. I don't know. But it's food by 50. I think they still use 50 grams of the food. So for something like white sugar, you don't eat 50 grams of white sugar. That's almost 2 ounces. But for something like vegetables, depending on the weight, maybe you'll eat more than that, you know? So it's like 2 pieces of bread. And I just don't find it a value. But the way I like people to eat is always have some sort of healthy fat. So at breakfast, that would be nuts on your breakfast cereal, like almonds or walnuts, or the peanut butter, or use olive oil to cook a vegetable, put an egg on that, put that on your toast. So that's your fat there. Healthy fat at lunch is olive oil. Healthy fat at dinner is olive oil. So you're getting fat all day long. So I don't think of it as something you would combine, except that that's how you make a meal. Not from like a health standpoint. It's just the way it goes together.
Yeah. All right. Very interesting. This is all, you know, I've been wondering in my mind sort of how to bring together the Mediterranean diet and, you know, things that you read about and hear about with glycemic index. And then also, like I'd mentioned, this dietary inflammatory index. And it seems like in a lot of ways, at least the dietary inflammatory index, from what I was reading in comparison to the Mediterranean diet, there's a lot of, it's kind of saying the similar things.
That's what I think is kind of unfortunate, that a lot of nutrition is, I don't want to use, for lack of a better word, it's boring. Because you just say a Mediterranean diet is plant-based, use olive oil. And then people would say, well, I'd like to eat a ketogenic diet, or I'd like to eat, you know, like a low inflammatory diet. And you look at the diets, you think they're making it more complicated. And I find that patients who do that, they don't want to really lose weight, because they're not putting the work to it is not that hard. They're trying to complicate this thing and making it more difficult than it need to be. And that's why I think, you know, olive oil is such a bonus, because it keeps you full, gives you health benefits, makes things taste better. And it's good for all diseases. If you look at things like coconut oil, that was, you know, a big deal. How many years ago? 5 years ago. Do you hear about it anymore? No. Because even then, there were no studies showing it had benefit. Extra virgin olive oil has been used for more than 6,000 years. And people are realizing the health benefits. So people are amping up the production, which is great. They grow them differently now, so they can more quickly strip the trees. You want to make the olive oil as quickly as possible from the fruit being picked. So the quicker it's made, the fresher it is, the higher the health benefits. And that's why very often, not always, but very often when olive oil wins a prize for some sensory value, like taste, it's usually very fresh. And so it can be healthier, but it's not always the case. That's not always the case.
Okay. I know that we had only planned for an hour, but since you did mention the ketogenic diet, that I would be fascinated to hear if you had any thoughts, but only if you have the time.
Yeah, time, that's fine. So how would you like to know about it? From what standpoint?
Well, yeah, your thoughts about it. I kind of touched on it a little bit before with talking about this idea of maybe trying to have a dinner that would kind of help to keep your insulin lower as you would, you know, throughout the night and continue into the morning. So kind of doing time-restricted eating or sort of intermittent fasting for 16 hours a day.
Well, that's just, you know, when people say intermittent fasting, that's what I point to. If you have your dinner at a reasonable time and then you go to sleep, I mean, this sounds really stereotypic, and so I apologize in advance for this, but I find very often when people are eating late, it's a problem with their ability to get organized. And so you organize your day in such a way that you can eat at a reasonable time. Or you have, like, if you make a plant-based meal in the summer, if I'm going to be late, I make the meal in the morning while I'm having my breakfast, put a cover on the pan and just leave it all day and come home and heat it up. I mean, they're not hard to make. But so my problem with the ketogenic diet is that to me, the foods you're eating are not healthy. The ketogenic diet, when it was originally defined, it was about 90% fat. And it was a liquid diet. So that's when they did like the original epilepsy studies in kids and years ago. And so they would give them these liquid things to drink that were, I'm not sure what fat they used, but it was fat based. So now what happens is it's proportionally a little more in protein, but it is always low in carbohydrate. It might be less than 20 grams a day. It might be less than 50 grams a day, but it's always low. Low in carbohydrate, high in protein, mainly high in fat. But if you're eating something like beef, you're going to get protein and a lot of fat. So that combination. So my major concern with it is that there's really no food on it that's healthy. I mean, they allow you some salad greens usually, and maybe like tomatoes, but they're not getting the food you need. Where it's becoming really talked about is in the cancer area. And I think what it gets into is the idea that high blood glucose, which is bad for everything, but glucose above a healthy level. So that's 100 milligrams per deciliter fasting, or an A1C above like 5.8-ish. Okay, so 5.7 is better than 5.8, and go up from there, it's not good. So extra glucose in the system can potentially feed cancer cells. So this is where I'm seeing articles in journals, that reputable journals, saying maybe we should test a ketogenic diet for people with cancer because we can lower the glucose that way. And I'm thinking to myself, that is just crazy, because now you're going to tell them to eat foods which do nothing for improving their health. So from that, I say if you eat a plant-based olive oil diet with a reasonable amount of carbohydrate, you don't exceed the carbohydrate that you need, so your glucose stays low. And the olive oil, the extra virgin olive oil, makes your insulin work better. It gets the glucose and insulin low. So it's a much better diet. And I'm like blown away, because I just read one that was ketogenic diets for athletes, which is really weird. I'm thinking athletes need carbohydrates. So for them to say not, I just don't get it. So I just see them as unhealthy. The other thing is people don't go into, you know, ketosis, like bad ketosis. They make ketones. But, you know, when this became popular, which was around 2000, 1998, 2000, I was teaching undergraduate nutrition, and I had a whole bunch of young males on ketogenic diets. And it was because Atkins was really big at that time. And I used to say to them, you know, if you were an ER, you know, nurse or physician, and someone came in and you picked up ketones in their blood, you wouldn't say, oh, great, you know, that's wonderful. It's not wonderful. It's changing the pH. It's oxidizing their body. It oxidizes LDL. It does all these awful things. Yes, you're losing weight, and losing weight is always a good thing, but how you get there, you want to get there a healthy way. And a ketogenic diet is just not going to do that for you.
That's an interesting sort of summary. And I've seen that before, where people sort of, you know, as part of the ketogenic diet, you can eat a lot of meats and fats and vegetables, but the vegetables kind of go at the wayside for people. They tend to just eat a lot of bacon.
It's only 20 grams usually. Some people allow you up to 50. I think over 50 grams of carbohydrate, you're not going to make ketones. And that's where people think that it's advantageous. They say it changes the chemistry of the cancer cell. I just, I'm blown away. I was talking to my students about it. The class that I teach in the spring is small. And I was talking to them about it. And I said, you know, if you want to use it, because they have to do a case where they have to get someone to lose weight, I said, go ahead and do it. Because I said, it is becoming mainstream. I just want you to know why it's not healthy. And that's where I think, and I see dietitians recommending it. It's not just, you know, physicians, but I think that people are not looking at the long game and saying, I can get the weight off this person, I can get the glucose down, but what am I doing to their health? What am I doing to other risk factors? And you can do that with extra virgin olive oil as opposed to using a lot of protein.
So kind of everything just pointing back to this, to keeping it vegetable-based or keeping it plant-based, having a reasonable amount of carbohydrates and having healthy fats, extra virgin olive oil, things like nuts and things like that.
The other thing is if you're not eating enough carbohydrate, your body's going to have to use protein for energy, kind of break it down. And that's much more complicated than using carbohydrate. Carbohydrate is the easiest, then lipids, fatty acids. And protein is just, you've got to go through the amino acids have to be changed to glucose. And it's just like this mixed up biochemistry. And you're potentially robbing skeletal muscle to get some of those amino acids if you don't have them available. So I don't know. I always say to my students, never forget your biochemistry. You know, biochemistry is key, because if you lose that and now you're looking at a diet, I said, just think it through. I said, it doesn't matter how it's advertised. It doesn't matter how it's promoted. Think it through and say, you know, years from now, have this little voice in your head saying, does this make sense? I mean, is this something I should be doing? So
that way. Well, thank you. I feel like we've done a really good sort of exploration of the Mediterranean diet, about extra virgin olive oil and some of these different sort of fad diets that have come out. I do like to end the show with a question about just brain health in general, and you being, you know, a high achieving, energetic person. I'm curious, you know, is there anything that you've found in your life, maybe other than what we've already talked about, that is sort of a powerful non-cliche strategy or technique that helps you have good brain health?
All right. For me, I can name two things. So one of them is I start every day speed walking. I wake up with a ton of energy and I have to disperse it, I always think, but it clears my head out. It's just phenomenal how it clears my head out. And I also find when I'm walking, I think of these things. Like even this morning, I was trying to figure out this work-related problem. And it's like, wow, it came to me. You know, I said, then, you know, it's just like, I just find it very beneficial. I don't think you can overestimate how much benefit exercise gives you. The other thing is, I've been my entire life, I'm Irish Catholic, practicing my Catholic faith. And I do think there's tons of problems with Catholic Church. And my father always says, don't confuse the Catholic faith with the Catholic Church. And so my prayerfulness, I think prayerfulness for me is really important, because it gives me a sense of like there's something beyond me, that when, you know, my thinking is I should make the world better when I leave it. It isn't about me. It isn't about making me better. And that releases a lot of stress, because to me, you're not saying I've got to do this. And if this happens, it's like, you know, I believe in what I call divine order, which is a common term, but it means there's a reason for everything. And I find that very often, if you look back on your life, things that you thought were the worst things that could happen to you, if you go through it and think it through, it actually is a really growing experience. And so it becomes really beneficial. And so it's not that bad. And so whenever something really awful happens, I always have to say, okay, what is good can come out of this. And it usually does, you know? So those are my two things. It's like prayer and walking. And it's like how people meditate, you know, people find meditation useful. Right. So that I think could be, but I think prayer in a lot of ways is meditation. It's just meditation with a higher meaning. So those are my things.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Mary. I really appreciate those thoughts. And I'm excited to sort of be collecting everyone's different little brain health nugget at the end of the show. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. Good luck to you. Thanks for asking me.
Of course. Yeah, it was great chatting with you. Is there any way that people can find you or learn more information about you?
They can. So I was going to say that. So I have a website that's called medfooddiet.com. For you, it's in my signature. Mm-hmm. And on that, there's some things, there's nutrition, but there's recipes. There's videos of my recipes being made by students. There's the whole, you may be aware that I did a cooking program looking at food insecurity in the medical school. And so I showed that we could decrease food insecurity. So the program's there that people can replicate it. What else is on there? I'm trying to think, but it has recipes. And I'm actually, because you know, I'm having this working at home is so much more efficient, I'm putting more recipes up. And I think that's what people need to look at is how do you translate this? So if they look at the recipes, realize how easy they are. Most people can then adapt things that they're already making into the same. Usually I say to people, it's usually a matter of adding olive oil and vegetables and taking out what I call animal flesh, poultry, seafood, meat. Take those out, add those foods. Even if you do it 3 nights a week, that's where I showed that you could decrease food insecurity. But it also led to lower body weight. It led to better glucose control. So it doesn't have to be every day. It's just, you know, it's a start. But the more you do it, the better your budget will be for groceries and the better your health will be.
Hey, listeners, some of you have so kindly asked how you can support the podcast. You can help by supporting us on Patreon, so please kindly find our Patreon link in the show notes. You can also support us by leaving a review, so please let me know what you think about the show by leaving a review on iTunes. You can find me on Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, and Facebook as Dr. Nissen. And it's important to note that this podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice. No doctor-patient relationship is formed. And the use of this information and the materials linked to this podcast is content of this podcast and is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice from any medical condition they have, and they should seek the assistance of their healthcare professionals for any such conditions.